The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
For my sermon today, I'm going to talk about a favorite subject of ours, and that is sin. And you might be saying, well, that's not a favorite subject. And although that may be, it is certainly one we're very familiar with. So if you'd please turn over to Leviticus in chapter 23 to begin today. Today is the first day of unleavened bread, and it is officially the first day that we are to not eat anything that contains leaven. Now, of course, this pictures removing sin from our lives and then replacing it with something else, something that is holy, eating bread that is not leavened, putting Christ inside of us, as it were. And we do this every day of this feast. Now, the origins of this feast began thousands of years ago when God delivered the Israelites out of Egypt. And he instructed them to remove the leaven from their bodies and from their homes. And this was a way of showing them that they were going to have to remove sin from their lives and now take a different path and now begin to live righteously, walking in the way of the Lord. And this is documented in Leviticus 23, when it lists the feasts of the Lord. And beginning in verse 4, it says, "These are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their seasons. In the 14th day of the first month, at even, is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread unto the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. In the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work, but you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days, and in the seventh day is an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein." So while proclaiming the holy convocations to take place in the first and last day of unleavened bread, here is mentioned that 7 days we must eat unleavened bread. Now this was done by Israel as they fled from Egypt, and it was a way to show them, a way to show that they are going to come out of sin, come out of the bondage of sin that they were committing while they were in Egypt. And they were going to be delivered into the liberty of serving God and serving Jesus Christ, as was pointed out in Mr. Feller's sermon last Sabbath. Now, soon after this, God gave to them his law, the great Ten Commandments, the moral code of the universe. And this law is based upon love. It's based upon everything that is good for us. This law showed them, and it showed us, exactly what is required of God's people. It shows all of us what we should and what we should not do in seeking righteousness and in seeking God's kingdom. And we must follow this moral code in order to find true freedom, in order to find true happiness and blessings from our Creator. If you turn over to 1 John in chapter 3, 1 John in chapter 3, to sin, as Mr. Brady had pointed out, is to go against the great moral code, that is the law of the universe, the Ten Commandments, to go against that which is holy. The law is holy, it's just, it's good, as Paul said. And when we sin, we transgress against goodness, against love, against God's given law to all of mankind. In 1 John in chapter 3, and beginning in verse 4, it very clearly points this out as it says, "Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law. For sin is the transgression of the law." So when we do opposite of the holy law of God, it is sin. Sin is defined as defiant behavior against the laws of God. What is the entire basis of the law? Well, I had mentioned it earlier. It is love, isn't it? The whole law is based upon love. And Christ said that the entire teachings of the law and of the prophets hang upon these two things, which are similar: the love for God and the love for our brother. When we sin, we go against that love. And we go against that which we are supposed to have for one another and which we are supposed to have for God. Now, today, I'm going to talk about this thing that envelops the entire world. And it is sin. Yes, the entire world. You and I included. Now, we may think that we in the church are less likely to sin and that we have a lesser chance to transgress the law. In some ways, this is true. But is there really less probability for us to sin? Or do we instead sin in seemingly smaller matters, things that don't seem as important? Well, again, let's look at the example of leaven in our homes. Before this feast began, you know, we're going to start cleaning our homes and removing the leaven from everywhere, from every room in the house. And if you're like me, the first thing you do is you go through all the cabinets and you look at all the different foods you have and you pull all of them out of the cupboards and you put them on the counter and you look in the fridge. What do I have? You put it all together and you look in the freezer and you put it all together. And then for the next several days, you eat as much leaven as you possibly can. Right? You stuff yourself with pizzas, croissants, cookies, crackers, little snack, frozen snack things. There's so many products out there that contain leaven, and we realize how much it is a part of our lives. Pies, cakes, donuts, brownies, all the delectable foods that we love so much that contain leaven, we just pig out on them. Now, this, of course, leaven represents sin. We know this. And when we put leaven into our bodies during these days, it would be like sinning, right? It's putting sin into our bodies. But isn't this like a peculiar people, I think? You know, the days are coming where we can't have any leaven. We're not supposed to sin. So let's get as much as we possibly can before the days begin. Let's just force it in. Maybe there's an analogy there. Maybe not. But I thought it was very funny. And then, of course, the last day of unleavened bread, at sundown, we rush right out and we get croissants or garlic toast or pizza or whatever we can to start putting that leaven back in our bodies again. And I think it's kind of an interesting analogy there, because sin is enjoyable. If sin was not enjoyable, it would be easy to not transgress the law, but it is enjoyable. People like to sin, and it's hard to remove from our lives. But why do we do this? Why do we work so hard to remove leaven for the days of unleavened bread and then quickly usher it back in? Could it be that it is more like sin that we want to admit? Do we have a desire to do God's will, but at the same time have a passion for pleasing ourselves? Now, God did not choose leaven as an example of these days randomly. It wasn't just like, okay, I'll just pick leaven. That sounds pretty good. Let's use that one. No, this was premeditated because it has a deep spiritual meaning. And I wish you would have chosen something else. It would have been great if this would have been the days of no Brussels sprouts or the days of not eating asparagus. I mean, that would be very easy to do. But no, leaven is a lot like sin, and it's something that we enjoy. And the symbols that God chose on this day have a deep spiritual meaning for every one of us. Leaven, like sin, is everywhere. It's lurking around the corners. It's in the cracks and the crevices of our lives. It's waiting for us in the snacks and in the sauces. And we have to be careful. It's hiding in the ridges of the wafers. Something to think about. It's just waiting for us to pick it up and put it into our mouths. You know, leaven is actually in the very air that we breathe. It is. There are microscopic spores of leaven in the air that we breathe. And so if you leave dough out for a period of time, it will begin to rise on its own because of the leaven that's in the air. Now, isn't this just like sin to us? It's everywhere. It's all over the place. It's in the air we breathe. It is although we may not like it, a part of us, because we are flesh and blood. Let's turn over to Romans in chapter 7. Romans in chapter 7. Sadly, brethren, leaven, like sin, is a part of every one of us, whether we like it or not. We are flesh, and therefore we sin. And leaven flows through our mouths and into our stomachs, into our lungs, and then comes back out again, just like sin. And leaven, of course, I believe, is a perfect representation of how sin is in our lives. It's something that is physical, but it also is spiritual. Romans in chapter 7, beginning in verse 14. And here is a very familiar passage. We've read it many times, but still kind of confusing to some. And I hope to shed a little bit of light on what Paul was telling the church at Rome in this passage. Beginning in verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I know not. And I'm reading from the New King James Version. That which I do, I know not. For what I desire, that I do not do. But what I hate, that I do. So here, I believe, brethren, Paul is describing sin that is in each and every one of us. Even when you do not see it, it is there because we are carnal. It is a part of our nature. We can think we do not sin, but yet we do. Sometimes without even knowing it. We desire to be righteous, but we sometimes find it hard to accomplish this task. We can hate sin, and we can try to remove it. But like the very air we breathe, it is a part of us because we are mortal, flesh, and blood. We can never completely remove sin from our lives while we are flesh and blood. Continuing in verse 16, it says, if then I do that which I do not desire, I consent to the law that it is good. But now it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. So even if we do not desire to sin, we do. And by realizing this, we consent that the law is good, is what Paul says here. It is therefore not our spiritual minds sometimes that sin, but sin that dwells in us. And I believe that's what he's trying to convey here. But continuing in verse 18, for I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I do not find. For I do not do the good that I desire, but the evil which I do not will, that I do. But if I do what I do not desire, it is no more I working it out, but sin dwelling in me. Paul here states how to be completely good and righteous while in the flesh is something we cannot do. We can have the will to do it. Oh, yes, and we should. But how to perform or how to accomplish this task, we cannot find. It is because we are inherently sinful by nature. And that, like leaven, is something that we cannot totally remove from our lives. Not completely. It is because of our flesh that we are without spot, or not without spot. Now, we can think we can go a week or several weeks without sinning, but even when we do not willfully commit sin, we sin. And when this happens, it's not because we desire to sin, but it is because, as Paul states, sin dwells in us. So that is what Paul is telling us here. But does this mean we should not strive to remove sin from our lives? Because it's there, we can't get rid of it? Oh no, I'm not saying this at all. We must try. But even Jesus Christ, who was as perfect as any mortal being can completely be, he still said, why do you call me good? There's none good but the Father in heaven. Christ was clarifying the fact that no one can be totally sinless and therefore classified as perfectly good while in the flesh. Now, he may have been as perfect as we could possibly be as a mortal being. And I do believe that he was without sin, but he felt the pulls of sin on his flesh. He felt it gnawing at him, pulling at him, but he would not give in to it. He had a full measure of the Holy Spirit. He was the very Son of God, and he would not give in to that which beckoned him, which is something that many of us give in to and sin. Only a spirit being, I think, is what he was saying. Only a spirit being magnificent beyond our comprehension can be classified as good, through and through, goodness. And that is God, as Christ had stated. Continuing in Romans 7 and verse 23, it says, "But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, being in my members. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this from the body of this death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin." There it is. It's a law of sin in our flesh. A law in our members that we are captive to sin, like the air that we breathe, containing tiny microscopic spores of leaven. We cannot totally remove it. But we can fight it, can't we? We can lessen its pull on us. We can remove large pieces, chunks of sin out of our life. And we can do this through the power of the Holy Spirit and through Jesus Christ. And that is why we put unleavened bread into our bodies each day of this feast, picturing putting Christ in us every day to get rid of that leaven that is inherently in our bodies. And we can toss out boxes of cookies and crackers and dozens of donuts. We can remove lots of sin. We can. And I think that's what these days picture. Look at, you can do a fairly decent job. But we have a law in our members that sin cannot be completely removed. But through Christ, we can remove a lot of it. And I need to stress that to us today, because I don't want us to think, well, I can't remove it and stop giving it their all, making an effort. We must do this. And so let's think about it. How much sin have we weeded out of our lives this last year? How many areas of our lives have we cleaned up and vacuumed? Did we clean the living room and the kitchen? Well, what about the basement? What about the closets of our life? What about the car? Did we work on that? Or did we feel that doesn't need any work? I don't need any cleaning up in that area of my life. You see the analogy I'm trying to make here. How many areas are we not working on? Are we not considering? Because these days, picture removing sin totally, removing leaven totally from our lives, and not just the places where we can openly see it, in our cupboards and in our refrigerator. Now, we might think that we're doing pretty well and we're keeping the commandments of God, and therefore we don't have too much to clean up on our lives. But are we really? Do we have it all together? Or are we missing something when that vacuum comes rolling by? Let's turn over to Exodus in chapter 20. Exodus in chapter 20. Now, the world, we know, brethren, is filled with obvious, blatant, and intentional sin by millions of people. So we may look at them and think, well, we're pretty good. Not too much to work on in our lives. I'm not sinning like, Joe down the street. I'm not sinning like Susie over at the corner market. But let's look at some examples of very obvious sin in the world by going through the commandments, and I'm just going to do each one briefly, but I wanted us to compare it to ourselves and to our lives, areas where we may think we're clean and we're doing a good job, but we might just need to scrub just a little bit harder, work it a little bit more. Exodus in chapter 20, beginning in verse 3, it is the first great commandment of God. You shall have no other gods before me, as it states. Now, it is clear that the world we live in is filled with people that worship other gods, whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism, Confucianism, there's even voodoo. These are all religions that worship these strange and false gods. But even most professing Christian religions in the world fall into this category because they pray and worship a God that they claim did away with his commandments, that said it's okay to change the Sabbath to some other day, that puts his stamp of approval on the pagan holidays that they observe. And that's not the God you and I worship. That's not the true God. So I think that these people would fall into the category of having other gods before him. But this is an easy one for us, right? I mean, we worship the true God. Well, yes, we do worship the true God. But do we really have it all together? That's what I want us to consider. You know, how often do we let our personal pleasures, our personal desires get in the way of Bible study or prayer? You know, it could be a TV, various TV shows that we want to watch, or maybe we have certain hobbies that take up a lot of our time. Now, these things are not wrong in and of themselves. You know, that's not what I'm saying. But if these things take up too much of our time, it can be problematic, because then we start to cut ourselves off from God, and then these other things become a God to us in his place. If they encroach too much on our spiritual growth, they creep into breaking, I believe, the spiritual application of this first commandment. And it's something we should consider. Let's look at the second commandment in verse 4 of Exodus 20, where it says, "You shall not make to yourselves any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heavens above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth." And so throughout the world, we see people praying to images of cows or overweight Asians or multi-breasted human-like creatures. And I'm not sure what that is, but they're obviously having idols. But again, the professing Christian community prays to paintings of long-haired, effeminate-looking men, images of the Virgin Mary or various saints. And I believe this falls into the category of breaking this commandment. But we do not do this, do we? Well, we might not be praying to these images, but what about that desire for that special car, or wanting that antique tea set, or maybe that satellite navigation system? You know, does our desire for physical things sometimes become a driving factor, something that motivates us, and not letting God motivate us instead? Now, these things, again, they're not wrong in and of themselves, but if they take too much of us away from God, they can become an idol to us. And I would like us to consider if, you know, satisfying the physical pleasures, the lusts of this life, become an idol to us, and we seek them out instead of seeking God. Let's look at the next commandment, the third commandment, beginning in verse 7, where it says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes his name in vain." Now, some people relate this commandment to using God's name in a way that is cursing. And although there might be a relationship to this, I believe what this commandment is truly saying is, do not claim to be one of my people and then not do what I tell you to do. Do not claim to be a Christian and not keep the commandments, taking the name of the Lord in vain. Now, this breaking of this commandment, I believe, is clearly seen in the Protestants, the Catholics, the Mormons, who they actually have their own Bible. They believe the real Bible is valid, but theirs takes precedence over it. You know, the Baptists, there's several other Pentecostals, there's many other religions that use the Holy Bible, but they do not do what God says. And I believe this is taking his name in vain. They do not practice what God preaches. But do we sometimes drift into this category? Are we claiming to be a true Christian and not internalizing what God tells us to internalize, putting it in our hearts and doing it with our members? Do we attend services and then we tithe in hopes of just escaping the wrath of God, the tribulation? Do we act a certain way when we're with the brethren, but then when we get out into the world, our old man comes right back up and we're somebody different? Do we sometimes give God lip service this way by not internalizing his word? It's something to consider for all of us, myself included. Let's look at the fourth commandment. Now this one, I'm only going to mention briefly because I think this is very obvious, that remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now we know most of the people in this world break this commandment. Of this we can be sure. But, you know, we should consider that if we are not creeping into breaking this commandment, you know, maybe we are reading or watching things on television that we should not be reading or watching on the Sabbath. Or maybe we're making plans for next week or that vacation that we want to take. You know, this falls into the category of doing our own pleasure. And it's a time that we should focus on God and the things of God and do what he instructs us to do. Let's look at the fifth commandment. Exodus 20, verse 12, where it says, "Honor your father and your mother so your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you." Now today there's an obvious, abhorred disrespect for parents. You know, most youth today, they don't think that mom and dad are hip, that they're not street savvy and they don't have it quite together like they do. You know, teenagers often feel that their parents don't know what it's like to be a teenager. And so they're kind of out of tune and out of touch with the way they are. This leads to children or teenagers, the youth, treating them like they're acquaintances and not like they're good friends, which a parent should be to their children. They don't look at them as people to be inquired of, people to be learned from, people to be respected for the most part. Again, I'm not labeling all children or youth. I'm just saying for the most part, out in the world, we see this every day. Now, I believe this attitude begun sometime probably in the late 50s or early 60s. And the reason I mention this is because it's interesting that those children that were born or lived during that time when this rebellious breaking of the fifth commandment, I believe, started on a large scale anyways, this lack of honoring their parents led to a lack of respect for the elderly, I believe. And so nowadays we see people, for the most part, they don't treat, you know, the grandparents or the elderly people the way they should. They don't have a decent amount of respect in honoring them. And so they'll put them into senior citizen homes or, you know, kind of let a stranger take care of them for the last final days of their lives. And I think this is very sad. You know, we should really respect the older people in our community. And I believe this is directly related to breaking the fifth commandment. You know, we should always treat our parents with respect and the elderly with honor. And I believe this is part of the reason God said in Leviticus to honor the hoary head, meaning the gray-haired person, and to honor the face of the old man. And at the closing of this, he says, "And fear thy God." This is a command from him. It's showing respect to them is showing respect to him as well. You know, there's often wisdom in years, and older people have experienced so much. You know, they've been out in the world, they've seen a lot of things, they have very interesting stories to tell, and a lot of wisdom to share with the younger people. But young people don't want to hear it for the most part. They're kind of in their own world. And then comes the sixth commandment, which is verse 13 of Exodus 20, "You shall not kill." Now, murder is running rampant throughout this world. A United Nations crime survey revealed that there were 180,300 people murdered between 1998 and the year 2000. Now, the countries that bear the majority of these numbers are India, Russia, South Africa, Mexico, and the United States, respectively. Now, but I want something I want to add here is that these are only the documented cases. And this is what they said in the survey. They said the number is likely much higher than this. And then there are hate crimes. Now, I'm not talking about crimes of prejudice, although those fall into this category. I'm talking about acts of violence that are carried out by people who hate the other person. They find themselves in a fit of rage and unleash, you know, their judgment upon the person. Assaults is what the crime fighters call it. Between 1998 and the year 2000, there was a shocking 5,100,000 assaults around the world. And these are associated with hate, which according to Christ is spiritually breaking the sixth commandment directly. Now, not surprisingly, the melting pot of the world, which is the United States, bears more than half of this number, with 2,238,000 plus assaults in this country in a two-year period. And again, these are only the documented cases. The number is likely much higher than that. But we in the Church of God, we do not murder, do we? We do not assault people. Well, we don't. Hopefully not. But do we instead loathe people? Do we kind of dislike being in their presence and kind of feel this inner anger towards them? Do we sometimes get upset and maybe get a little fit of rage and tell them how stupid they are or how much we hate them? It's something to consider, because we can sometimes let this happen. But we are not to do this. These are feelings that we must control, and we must learn to have the mind of Christ and to be spiritually minded in keeping this sixth commandment. Now, Christ said to love thy enemies, and I believe this was an example that he was referring to the spiritual application of keeping the sixth commandment. The seventh commandment in verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. Now, the acts stemming from those who break this commandment in our world today fuels our entertainment industry. Now, while most people would agree that cheating on your spouse is wrong, they have no problem lusting after people outside the marriage through movies, through magazines. Now, because of this, the media is filled with sex and with risque images just to sell products much of the time. Girls in bikinis and half-naked bodies catch the eye of the American people. And they make us look, we're kind of fixated for a little bit on that image. Well, this lustful attitude, I believe, adds to another crime statistic, and that is rape. Now, over just a one-year period, there were 787,000 cases of rape in this country. That is a staggering number. Now, again, these are just the cases that are reported. You know, one of the most startling aspects of sex crimes is that many of them go unreported, because the victims usually feel embarrassed, or they fear reprisal from the abuser. And this is because the rapist is often somebody that the victim knows. 28% of victims are raped by husbands or boyfriends, 35% by acquaintances, and 5% by other relatives. And the FBI estimates that actually only 37% of all rapes are reported to the police. So you could almost double that number that I just gave you. And this world, brethren, is plagued with sex crime. But we in the church don't fall into this trap, and we do not commit adultery. Do we? Well, how often do we scan the TV stations and pause on the images of sexual activity? Or how often do we go out into the world doing our business and we kind of admire somebody we're talking with, admire their beauty just a little more than we should? Or how often do we thumb through magazines and stop on the images of people that are half-dressed? Now, Christ told us that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in their heart already. And this is spiritually keeping the seventh commandment. And many, even in the Church of God, do this today. We should consider, brethren, that we could be breaking God's commandments, spiritually, if not physically. Maybe not directly in the extreme, but indirectly on a seemingly lesser level, but breaking them nonetheless. And by removing bits and pieces of leaven in our lives, crumbs out of our lives, if you will, we learn that all sin needs to be removed, not just the big ones, even the ones that we may feel are lesser. All sin deserves death. The scriptures state this, and that was shown by Jesus Christ dying for us. It all deserves death, not just the big sins. Christ made this very clear to us. We should try and remove every aspect of sin within our power, because we do have the ability, through Christ, to remove much of the sin in our lives. The next two commandments, beginning in verse 15, are, you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. I'm going to kind of lump these together, because sometimes breaking these two commandments go hand in hand. And we see, brethren, that the theft, the lying, the deceit in this world are obvious. Deceiving others in order to gain, for personal gain, for money, the numbers are insurmountable. It's huge. And this is big business today. But whether being held up by gunpoint, mugged, breaking and entering a home or business, embezzlement, swindling, false representation, twisted truths, there's many crimes associated with breaking these two commandments. Again, some shocking statistics. Robbery, 2,220,000 cases worldwide every 2 years. 400,000 of these, I might add, are in the United States. Burglaries worldwide, 6,389,000, one-third of which are in the United States. Car thefts, 3,630,000, again, nearly a third in the United States. Embezzlement, 214,000 cases worldwide. And cases of fraud, 2,630,000 cases. Now, this should be a wake-up call to the world. What's going on? What are we doing wrong here? Because there's so much evil and sin out there. You'd think this would cause people to get angry, to get excited. Let's fix this. But they do not, because they truly do not want to fix the root of the problem, which is a lack of belief in the true God and a lack of keeping the Ten Commandments, the great moral code of the universe. But we as God's people do not steal. We do not lie, do we? How often do we fudge a little bit on our taxes? Or maybe decide not to report some of our earnings? Maybe we claim a little bit more than we should. Have any one of us ever been given a little too much change at a store, at a market, and just kept the money? And we might think we don't lie to our neighbors, but do we sometimes stretch the truth for our own benefit to make us look a little better than we are? Or maybe purposely mislead someone, leaving out some of the details to avoid an uncomfortable situation? Now, we may not be burglarizing or embezzling or breaking into people's homes, but do we sometimes deceive others in another way? A seemingly lesser sin, something that is, we feel that's not too big a deal. We can stretch it right here. This is something to think about, because it is spiritually breaking either one of these two commandments. The last commandment, the 10th commandment, beginning in verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now, this commandment is sometimes difficult for everyone, including those people in God's church. You know, because we all like nice things. We all can appreciate modern conveniences. And again, these things are not wrong in and of themselves. But does our desire for them go to the extent of truly wanting that what others have? Or are we happy, content with the things that God has blessed us with? Now the world lusts after stuff, after merchandise. It is filled with the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh. But brethren, this must not be so among you and I. We are to be different. We are called to something else, called to something better, a transcendent destiny that exceeds anything this world has to offer us. And the pools of this world, we need to learn to not allow them to hold any water with us. They're not important. The things of God are what is important to each of us. Let's turn over to Matthew in chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. Beginning in verse 5. And as was when his disciples were come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said unto them, Take heed, and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, It is because we have taken no bread. Which when Jesus perceived, he had said unto them, O you of little faith, why reason you among yourselves? Because you have brought no bread? Do you not understand, neither remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up? How is it that you do not understand that I spake it not unto you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Then understood they how that he bade them not to beware of the leaven of the bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. So Christ's admonition to beware of false doctrine, that is wrong teaching of these Pharisees and Sadducees, it's clear to us. He wanted them to beware of what these religious leaders were trying to preach to the people, because it was not all good. They were mixing in bad in their teachings. It might be false. But what about the leaven of false teaching in the world today? How careful are we being in the doctrine that's being preached in this world today? The doctrine of the world. Do we believe everything we hear, or do we prove it out to uncover the truth? What about scholars, professors, television programs, magazine articles, and things of the like? Is this not something else that we should also be considering? Should we not beware of the doctrine of the movies and television? The newspapers? The music? Because they are preaching a message to people today. And the message is not coming from God. It is something that we must certainly be on guard about. There seems to be nothing in this world that Satan has not infected in some way. And we have to be on guard, as the leaven of sin has infected practically everything. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 5, back a few pages. These days show us, brethren, how nitpicky we need to be when it comes to the leaven of sin. They show us that we must take swift and even premeditated action to remove it from our lives. And Christ even went as far as to give us some bold instructions about how important it is to get rid of sin. In Matthew in chapter 5, beginning in verse 29, Christ says, And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that your whole body should be cast into hell. Well, by this example, by this statement of Christ here, it's clear that he's telling us we must do whatever it takes to get sin out of our lives. For that sin that easily besets us, he says, get rid of it, or you're in danger of being cast into the lake of fire. Have you ever heard the term scared straight? I think that term would fit the scripture. It's something for all of God's people to consider, because we are called to something else. The world isn't being called right now. We are. He's given us something of great value. Something that this world's currency cannot compare to. Nothing this world has to offer can compare to what is in store for us. And he's saying, do whatever it takes. Let's turn over to John in chapter 2 for a final scripture. John in chapter 2. Now, Christ did another thing that I think is a great example of how we sometimes need to be, and to what extremes we should take to remove sin. John in chapter 2, we're going to pick it up in verse 13, where it says, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the changers' money and overthrew the tables. And he said unto them that sold doves, take these things from here. Make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house has eaten me up. Christ came to the temple in Jerusalem to keep the Passover. And there he found people that were profiteering, if you will. You know, people would travel to Jerusalem long distances to keep the feast, and they desired to bring sacrifices and to make an offering to God. Now, they would often need to purchase such sacrifices because they traveled a long distance and they couldn't bring their animals with them. And many times they had to change money to the currency of the Jews at the time, and so they were money changers. Now, these sellers, these changers, were inflating the price of what they were selling and charging people to change their monies over. They were dishonestly profiting from the things of God. And Jesus saw this, and he made him sick. He zealously, angrily threw these people out of the temple. You get out of here. You don't do this here. You don't do it anywhere, but especially not here. He was upset. He tossed over tables. He physically forced these people out of the temple. Now, this wasn't done in just a fleeting moment of rage. He thought about this. He knew what he was going to do, and this is shown by him making a small scourge from a rope before he actually started to throw them out. Now, we should be like this, shouldn't we? We need to be like this when it comes to sin, if need be. Get upset. Think to yourself, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm throwing it out. Get rid of it, forcefully if we have to. Sin is something that we have to hate. We have to despise it. We have to loathe it to eradicate it from our lives. But sometimes we do not, because it's pleasurable. It's enjoyable. Sin is enjoyable. If it was not, it would be easy to get rid of. But it's something that we, as flesh and blood, enjoy. So we understand, brethren, that leaven is everywhere. It's even in the air we breathe, the microscopic spores of leaven. And like leaven, sin is everywhere. There are donuts around every corner. There's cookies in the crevices. We need Christ to come back. We need him to throw the money changers out of this world. But until then, we must use these days of unleavened bread to show us where we, through him and through the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, can get rid of sin and throw it out in preparation for his return. And so we have cleaned our homes of leaven, and hopefully we have taken steps to further clean our lives. But let's not stop cleaning now. Throughout the rest of this feast and beyond, let's continue to look for that leaven, that is sin, in our lives and seek it out. And not only remove it, but take premeditated measures to keep it from entering in. Let's have a great feast of unleavened bread.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.